I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We can probably all agree that getting more Kansas City 4-year-olds enrolled in pre-K would be a good thing. But a new proposal put forth by the mayor is raising eyebrows not because it calls for more early childhood education, but because of how it would be paid for, a new city sales tax. Today, we'll sit down with Mayor Sly James and ask him why he thinks his plan is the best choice for Kansas City's future. Then, it's on to sports. As the Royals fall apart and the Chiefs try to put something together, we'll focus on local players on the international stage in swimming, tennis, and golf with contributor Greg Ecklin. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. Kansas City Mayor Sly James wants voters to pass a new sales tax to help fund an expansion of pre-K services in the city. He explains why he thinks that's a good idea and responds to some of the critics of that proposal. That comes up in just a few minutes. But first, attention this morning has been focused on the Johnson County Election Office. Not the first time in the last few days that's been the case. It's there that the County Canvassing Board met earlier this morning to begin the process of reviewing provisional ballots cast in last week's primary election. The Republican gubernatorial primary between Secretary of State Chris Kobach and Governor Jeff Collier remains too close to call, and provisional ballots in Johnson County and around the state could play a decisive role in determining who the GOP sends to November's general election. For the latest, let's turn to KCUR's Kyle Palmer. Kyle, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Brian.
So let's start with what everyone wants to know. Did we find out? Has the vote count changed this morning?
Right now? No. Kobach leads Collier still by 110 votes. That's the unofficial count. That total was actually down from about 190 after mail-in ballots were tallied on Friday. But canvassing boards in all 105 Kansas counties were starting to meet today to review provisional ballots. As you said, there are estimated to be about 9,000 of those statewide, and really some 40% of them, nearly half, come from Johnson and Sedgwick counties alone.
So it really does matter what happens there in Johnson County. So what did the canvassing board get done this morning, Ben?
So this was a real window into the sausage-making of elections, if you will. This happens every election, but very seldomly does it play such a critical public role.
Usually
in deciding,
not a bunch of TV cameras. Yeah,
in deciding the results of an election. So what the canvassing board did today was decide out of a little more than 2,000 provisional ballots cast in the county which ones should and should not be counted as part of the canvassing process. So what the board ultimately decided before going to recess this morning was that 1,176 of these provisional ballots will be reviewed and counted. Another 275 will be partially counted. That means that the ballots votes for statewide office, including governor, will be counted, and other votes for more local offices will not, primarily because most of those voters voted in the wrong polling places. So their statewide vote could still count, but their local vote could not. So in total, nearly 1,500 of these provisional ballots will be counted, but about another nearly another 900, 898 to be exact, of these provisional ballots were thrown out this morning.
And how come? Why were those 900 thrown out?
So the county election board documents a list of 21 different reasons why these votes were thrown out. Some of them affect only a handful of voters. For instance, the envelope the ballot came in contained more than one ballot. There was an illegible postmark on the ballot. There were several dozen voters who did not provide photo ID when they voted, so their provisional ballot was thrown out. There was even one in which the voter cast a ballot on Tuesday and then has since died. And so that is a provision in which the county board can throw out the ballot. But the single biggest category of provisional ballots that were eliminated this morning were thrown out because of what is termed incorrect party affiliation change. 272 voters. Johnson County election officials say that these were voters who had registered for one party, in this case, the Democrats, but on election day insisted or chose to vote on the Republican ballot, which in Kansas primaries you can't do.
Very quickly, Governor Collier and Secretary of State Kobach both had representatives at the meeting, Kyle. That speaks to the tension that's rising between these two very prominent Republicans vying for the office.
Well, already election watchers are anticipating a legal battle. Attorney General Derek Schmidt last week sent out instructions to county election offices to keep their records, their ballots, their election data in case of a lawsuit after the final results are announced. The central legal conflict that's brewing statewide is an argument over whether voters who were unaffiliated affiliated on Election Day, not Democrat or Republican, whether they were forced to vote via provisional ballot. By Kansas law, voters can declare at a polling place and get a party's ballot and vote, but they have to fill out some paperwork, so there's already a brewing legal fight over what was the effect on those voters. In Johnson County today, at the canvassing board meeting, in fact, election officials there acknowledged that nearly 60 unaffiliated voters were incorrectly told to cast provisional ballots on Election Day, but in fact, those nearly 60 votes will be part of the larger group of provisional ballots that will be counted.
They got counted. When do we get those numbers?
So in Johnson County, we should actually know by tomorrow what the final certification total is for the county. The canvassing board is reconvening publicly at 4 p.m. tomorrow to complete the canvass process.
That's KCUR's Kyle Palmer. Kyle, thanks.
Thank you.
Mayor Sly James has about a year left in office, and one way he's looking to leave his mark on Kansas City is with a new way of funding pre-K education, programs for four-year-olds that he says will benefit them and the city for years to come. But he wants to do it in a way that many have raised questions about, a 3/8 of a cent sales tax, that on top of existing taxes that already exceed 10 cents on the dollar in some parts of the city. Nearly 2,000 citizens signed a petition to get the proposal on the ballot. But in order for that to happen, the city council will have to act within the next 10 days. And if they do, Kansas Cityans will vote on this plan in November. Joining us to talk about that tax and to try to answer some of those questions is Kansas City Mayor Sly James. Welcome back.
Good morning, Brian.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
So give us the overview. A 3/8 cent tax would bring in $30 million a year. Where would that money go?
Well, first of all, the money would go through a tax board that has to be set up by statute, five people. I appoint three, school districts appoint one, counties appoint another. They're the tax board. They're the ones who would be initially responsible for the money. That money would then go to the advisory board, who would decide and make recommendations as to how the money should be spent. It would be administered by Mark is the plan, Mid-America Regional Council, and the city council would make final decisions based on the recommendations made to it. The money ultimately is paid to providers of child care on a scale that includes such factors as family size, family income, and the quality of the pre-K school that the parents are sending the child to. It also, in the early years, would be used to scale up with more funding for teachers. This would have to be something where teachers were paid on a par with grade school teachers so that we would not lose high-quality teachers for pre-K to a grade school system because they would be paid more. It would also have to go in order for training to scale up the existing pre-Ks and childhood centers that are out there to raise the quality level, which is very important.
Now, usually when you've got a tax board that's making those kinds of decisions, it's for infrastructure. It's for something else that's within ordinary city services. You're talking about a tax board appointed a majority by the mayor that's making really important educational decisions.
No, the tax board doesn't make educational decisions. The advisory committee makes educational decisions, and the people on the advisory commission will consist of business people, a lot of educators, pre-K specialists, experts in early childhood development, parents who will be involved in the system. So the decisions on programming would not be made by the tax board. The tax board is there to satisfy the statutory requirements of being the initial handler of the money.
So that advisory committee would be appointed by you and your successors as mayor?
No, the advisory committee, the initial advisory committee will be appointed by me in conjunction with the chamber and the civic council and others who are already stakeholders in the process to make sure that we get the proper mix of people, those with skills that cover the bases from financial competency to educational and early childhood competency. Those are the people who will make the decisions. Those decisions would be adopted by the council through a vote. Mark would execute on the actual administration of the plan citywide.
It's quite a change from the way most education funds get distributed at the hands of school districts.
Yeah, it is. But those funds that are distributed to school districts are property taxes, and those property tax funds don't necessarily have to go to pre-K. If we are trying to do exactly what we're trying to do, which is to increase the availability of quality pre-K to every eligible student and child in this city, then property tax funds will not do it. This issue has been studied for about 5 years. In the course of that time, 7 CFOs of school districts have been involved in it. Early childhood people of various school districts have been involved in it. People who are in the early childhood space in terms of teaching and programming have been involved in it. Civic people have been involved in it. And every time that we've got there, the question was, okay, we think we can do this. How do we fund it? Nobody has found the way to fund it. Yeah. This is our way to fund it.
Yeah, you say the school districts have been involved in it. Are the school districts supporting this effort?
Depends on who you talk to in the school district. We have had a number of conversations with superintendents. The superintendents are concerned about who controls the money they would like to, who controls the governance they want to, and whether or not this is a voucher, which it is not.
And you don't think they should?
No, they shouldn't, because this is taxpayer dollars and it's controlled by statute. It's not a normal situation, not to mention the fact that the school districts have their own system. They do their own pre-K, but that's not what this is about. This is upholding and raising up pre-Ks and childhood systems across the board, whether they're school district related, private related, mom and pop related, religious affiliations. Only 35% of the kids in this city are being helped or being engaged in quality pre-K. We have 40% of the zip codes are in deserts where there is no quality pre-K. School districts have been doing this. They have not solved those problems. Secondly, this is not money that they would ordinarily control. They can't control it by statute. It has to be controlled. This is tax dollars, not property tax dollars. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole scheme in the statutory system that says what this has to be. They can't control it. And no, I don't believe they should control it, because they are a receiver of the funds. And if they're controlling the money while they would be receiving some of the funds, there would be some issues as to whether or not they were involved in conflicts of interest.
I mean, I think that's what a lot of people do have the questions about, though, the fact that some of these funds, which, yes, it's a sales tax instead of a property tax, but they're still public funds, would be going to potentially religious pre-Ks or private pre-Ks that may have whatever standards they choose to apply for who comes to those schools.
Well, that's not the case, because the plan requires open enrollment. You can't freeze them out, and if you do, then you simply will not be receiving tuition discounts through this plan. Secondly, it doesn't matter whether they're religious, private, or school-based. They have to follow the same curriculum, the DESE-approved curriculums that are out there, and those things will be monitored on an ongoing basis. You know, we need to get away from those issues about those types of things and recognize that we have 65% of our kids not being involved in quality pre-K and what that means, and what are we going to do about it. So we can't tell every kid that you've got to go to this school or that place to do that. What we are trying to do is to make sure that parents have the ability to take their child to a quality pre-K, which is extremely important in that year before kindergarten, to avoid all the ills that befall people who do not have a quality educational experience. And that means there's got to be access on a broader basis than currently exists. And that means in their communities, not necessarily where the schools are located, but in their communities, so that they can get their kids to school and so that they can work, etc.
And are there things built into how you are setting this proposal up that would ensure that the neediest students, the students in the parts of the city where there may be the most difficulty getting kids in pre-K program, benefit more than, say, parts of the city where people can already afford these pre-K programs?
Well, that's absolutely true. It's all based on every child is eligible, provided they meet the age requirement and the time requirement of 1 year before kindergarten. The sliding scale takes care of that. If you are a family of four with a $65,000 income sending your child to the top quality pre-K, then you're probably going to be in the 100% range of a tuition discount. If you're a family of four with $150,000, $200,000 income, then your discount is going to be significantly less. It might be $800,000 or $900,000 $100 or a couple thousand. The idea, though, is to recognize that, first of all, quality pre-K costs about $12,000 a year per child. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who can't afford that, can't get near that. So this is one way of helping them do that. And even at $150,000 a year, $12,000 for a four-year-old, when you might also have tuition issues for other kids older or what have you, or younger kids that are also doing it in some sort of child care, those are big hits.
Yeah.
We need to change that around and get more than 35% of our kids engaged.
We want to invite you to the conversation. How do you feel about the need for more money for pre-K education in Kansas City and about this way of paying for it, a new sales tax? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can put your questions directly to Mayor Sly James, 816-235-2888. You know, Mayor, obviously a lot of the concern has not been with the idea of pre-K or with the value of a pre-K education, but with this particular way of paying for it, a sales tax. A lot of people think we're already at the top capacity of what people in the city can bear. Anywhere from 7 to more than 10% sales tax in some parts of the city. What do you say to that?
I will say the same thing that I said to a parent who made that concern known to me the other day. It was a father who said that he understood the pre-K issues, but he didn't like the tax. And I asked him very simply about his own children and what he did. And he told me that he had taken on a second job to pay for his children's education. And I asked him why he did that. And he said, because education is the most important thing I can give them. And I said, well, you're doing that for your kids. I look at all the kids in this city as my kids, and I think that we have an obligation to provide the same type of fealty and the same type of approach for every child, especially when you consider the fact that literacy and crime are closely related, and when you consider the fact that 70% of the people in prisons read at a fourth grade level, and when you consider the fact that third grade reading proficiency is important because you're learning to read up to third grade on, you're reading to learn, and when you consider that kindergarten readiness is absolutely crucial to third grade reading, and then when you consider the fact that quality pre-K is essential to kindergarten learning. So basically, if we are going to continue to make investments, it's time for us to make some investments in some human capital, particularly our kids. We do a lot of bricks and mortar, but we don't have the workforce that is ready to challenge other workforces in the 21st century. We have too many people committing crime. We have too many people living in poverty. We can segregate our city in terms of life expectancy based on the zip codes they live in, which are also the same ones that suffer from a lack of educational options.
But that's precisely the concern a lot of people raise about a sales tax. A sales tax, sometimes called a regressive tax, where the poorest people are paying it at the same level as the people who have more wealth. But if the idea is to benefit those poorer residents of the city, why are you taxing them? Isn't this going to hurt them as much as it's going to help?
No, it's not, because for every dollar you invest in pre-K, you're going to get at least $7 back. So here's the deal. We can either pay early and try to make sure that we are giving our kids the chance to actually participate in a meaningful way in the society that they're going to be in and running, or we can wait until they get there and pay for them to go to prison at a much higher rate, because it costs a lot more to put a person in prison and keep them there than it does to keep them out in the first place. We have to get past this idea that somehow this is not an important investment. And that's what it really is. Investment in our kids is the right way. And secondly, we've been talking about this for years. There's been nobody else that's come up with any plan to pay for this. None. Property taxes won't do it because you can't ensure that the property taxes are going to get there. Secondly, property taxes only go to schools. They do not go to providers of pre-K. Secondly, property taxes have a big impact. They're the hardest tax to pass, not the easiest.
But I mean, we've already increased the property taxes. Water and sewer rates are going up. There's a gas tax on the ballot in November in Missouri.
Not necessarily. It's not there yet. But
well, there's a court fight about that. But does this concern you that adding more taxation at this moment is
when are we going to do it otherwise, Brian? When are we going to do it otherwise? What's a good time to do this? Should we wait another 5 years? How about waiting 10 until everything smooths out and everybody's got money? Let's try to do it in the middle of a recession. We've been talking about this for 5 years. When are we going to do it?
We had a question from Eric on Twitter. He asks, what other communities use sales tax for education? Are there other examples?
There are. Denver uses one. Cincinnati uses one. Seattle, I think, uses it. San Antonio uses it. There's a bunch of cities. As a matter of fact, of the 43 states that were the state funds any part of pre-K, of the 43 states, we're number 42. Okay? We're second to the last.
Well, that's a lot of people would say that's the problem, right? That this is normally something the state should be funding.
Well, they should fund the Buck O'Neill Bridge, too, but that's not happening. We can't wait around for people to save us. We have to go do these things ourselves. There's a lot of cities that do this, and they've done it with sales tax. And the very interesting thing is it's been wildly successful. Go to Denver now, and their program has expanded and continues to grow. San Antonio, same thing. These cities have done it. They've shown us the way. They've got the data to show that it works and what it means in the long term. That's something that we need to do, and that's why we're doing it now. And if somebody's got some other way that you can fund $30 million a year other than what we're doing, I wish they would have told us that 5 years ago.
The lack of support, or at least active support from school districts, you mentioned superintendents want to be able to control the funds, and they wouldn't be able to do it with this. What about the lack of city council members standing with you in this proposal?
Well, the city council will be briefed on Wednesday, and I think that there will be some changes in that. I'm not worried about that so much because I think what they need is some information. We've met with them individually. We're about to give them a very comprehensive plan for them to digest, and then we'll talk about it going forward to next Thursday.
Let's take a call from Elise, who's actually calling from Prairie Village. Elise, you're on with Mayor Sly James.
Hi. I was wondering if we would have more of a clear idea of who would be on that council. I know you said
you're speaking of the advisory committee, Elise, that would be making those decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yes, before it goes to a vote in November.
Will we know the names, Mayor?
Yeah, probably. But at this point, that's a campaign issue. And right now we're talking about the plan issues. But we have a schematic of what we expect to see there. We expect to see four people from the business community. We expect to see about seven people from the education community. We expect to see three parents, a current parent in the program, a legacy parent in the program, and a future parent in the program. We expect to see experts that are attached to it, either three or four. I don't remember the number. And those names will be drawn in as we consult with all of the stakeholders to determine who they should be.
Is the full plan actually available at this point?
It will be in a day or so. We're making some last-minute changes. We've did a lot of negotiations over the weekend, and we're making some changes, so it should be available within a day or two.
Who are you negotiating with? Who are you working with to develop the plan?
We have stakeholders that cover every aspect of this entire program, from the business community to the provider community, to the early education expert community, to the medical community, to regular parent community. So we're negotiating with, 20, 30 different people or representatives of different types of groups. And as we go forward and one change is made, it affects others. So we go back and check in. But we're pretty close. We're just putting some dots over I's and some crosses on some T's, I think, at this stage.
I think a lot of people, Mayor, would note that you've been a big supporter of economic development incentives, including TIF, tax increment funding, that many school districts say deprives them of the property tax income, that part of why there needs to be more education money is because of TIFs. I suspect you don't share that view.
No, because the bottom line, what they don't tell you is that the property tax that they currently enjoy would not have been available to them but for TIFs. They somehow seem to think that if you don't compete for business in this country and in this society and in this region, that it's just going to come and do it anyhow. It doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that. So first of all, the basic idea of TIF is that the property taxes that are already being paid continue to be paid. It's the increment above that is brought about by the additional work and renovation or additional development that is TIFed and used to pay off some of the stuff. And then at whatever period of time designated, that rolls off and you get the benefit of the full tax. Mm-hmm. So they're getting the benefit of the full tax on a whole lot of different things that, but for TIF, they wouldn't be getting.
So you don't think there's any conflict between alleviating their tax burden on the property tax side, but then increasing the sales tax on this side?
You know, that's a Hobson's choice. It's a choice that any decent city would not make, because you can't stop doing one to spite the other. Mm-hmm. You have to continue to develop and grow, and you have to continue to support our children.
Mayor Sly James is talking about his pre-K sales tax proposal. We've got a full board of calls at 816-235-2888. Let's talk to Rick in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Mayor, you're very, very passionate, and you're very knowledgeable. You're able to answer the questions quite quickly, and that shows a great deal of knowledge. What I'm still not clear on, however, is the issue of the property taxes. To me, the sales tax is the most regressive tax we have. Why can the city not either use the existing property tax method or create its own property tax so that we can fund it through a means that I think is far fairer?
Fair question. The city can raise property taxes.
Yeah, no. But the property taxes for education are usually raised by the district, and we certainly could cooperate and work on that. However, the problem is that a property tax won't necessarily be designated for pre-K. The first place that property taxes go is to schools, charter schools and public schools, etc. They can use that money for whatever they want. We need to look at pre-K, and the only way to do that is in this method. And no, we can't create a separate property tax for that. That's not an authority. We've looked at every single way of funding this that we could, from philanthropy to property taxes to sales taxes to hopefully God sending manna from the heavens.
Would you call this a last resort then?
This is the only resort. Nobody else has come up with a system, and we've looked at this for 5 years. We get through the planning, we know what the planning is, and then we get to how do you pay for it. This is the only way that we found to pay for it. And here's the thing about it. This needs to be considered an investment. This is an investment in the future of this city. It's an investment in trying to do long-term work to reduce crime. You're not going to reduce crime today by going out and trying to teach conflict resolution to 18-year-olds with guns. You're going to reduce crime by teaching conflict resolution to little kids who are in pre-K and learning how to deal with those situations. We have to look at the fact that we have 70% of the people in prison are reading at a fourth grade level. That's not by coincidence. We have to look at the fact that people on welfare, most of them are reading at low levels or illiterate totally. We have to look at the recidivism rate. We have to look at our workforce. We have to understand that Amazon, one of the reasons they wouldn't come here is we don't have the workforce to support it. And then we also have to look at the issue that our own businesses here in town have to go outside of this city looking for talent in order to be able to fulfill their job needs, and we're not doing anything about that. This is a way to do it.
Let's try to take one more call here from Kelly in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thank you. I really wanted to ask if there's been an analysis done about how many people from outside of Kansas City would be contributing to the sales tax, not just citizens of Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah, property taxes are only paid by the people who live there, but sales taxes get the rest of them too.
Sales taxes are paid by anybody who comes through and buys anything. Okay, so there's going to be a whole lot of people that pass through this city over in the ensuing years, as there are today, and it's going to be a lot of that money. I can't give you the percentage. Will come from people outside the city who are here for whatever purpose, vacation, business travel, whatever. So the burden doesn't fall exclusively on Kansas City residents, and we estimate based on the current process of looking at taxes that our finance department does, it'd be about $30 million a year.
Yeah, Mayor, before we let you go, you mentioned that ultimately one of the things you hope comes from something like this is a reduction in crime, a reduction in prison populations. The city is in the midst right now, it feels like, of a real rash of violent crimes. There's been a number of shootings, murders in the past month. How concerned are you about what's happening just in the last few weeks in the city?
Well, I'm not just concerned about the last few weeks. I was concerned the first murder, the second murder, the 13th murder. I'm concerned about the fact that we're living in slow motion mass murder in this city. We've been concerned about it. We are doing everything that we possibly can to reduce that, but we do not have all the tools that we have. We do not have the ability to control everything. A lot of these things are simply anger issues. Somebody cuts you off while you're driving down the street, you hop out with a gun and shoot them. Those are things that don't really speak well to people's ability to control their emotions, which is one of the things that pre-K and early childhood development teaches. Learn how to control your emotions when you're in conflict with another person. You can't stop it now by trying to do it with people who are already out there. We are concerned about it. The chief and I talk about it. The board and I talk about it. We talk about it, act on it, do everything we can, and we still can't stop it because we do not have the tools to deal with the root causes of poverty and lack of educational opportunities. Pre-K, quality pre-K, will address those issues, and it's a long-term response to a chronic problem.
It's Mayor Sly James. City Council has until August 23rd to put this on the November ballot. If they do, I'm sure this is not the last we'll hear about it. We had a lot of calls we didn't get to. Thanks for hanging on there, folks. And Mayor Sly James, thanks so much for taking a few minutes with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Appreciate it. When we come back, it's time for sports. We'll talk about local figures on the national scene in swimming, in golf, in tennis, and yes, in football. Stick around. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, Steve sat down with former Kansas City Mayor Kay Barnes to discuss her work kickstarting a downtown revitalization. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Join us tomorrow. Up to Date goes on the road for a live conversation from Johnson County's new Monticello Library. Steve Kraske will examine the modern role of libraries and why that county's building 5 new branches in the next 7 years. But today we're talking about sports. About 20 years ago, a Kansas City area athlete took the world by storm. Maurice Green, with roots in Kansas City, Kansas, became the world's fastest sprinter, and he won gold at the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, Australia. This time around, we're asking if history will repeat itself in the water. We're 2 years away from the Summer Olympics in Tokyo, and 19-year-old Michael Andrew of Lawrence is establishing himself as one of the fastest swimmers in the world. Over the weekend, he won the aquatic version of a sprint by taking the 50-meter freestyle title at the Pan Pacific Games in Tokyo. To talk about that and about other local athletes having an impact on the national and global stage, it's our regular monthly visit from Greg Ecklin, who reports on sports for KCUR. Hi, Greg.
Good morning, Brian.
Great to have you back. So how big a deal is the emergence of Michael Andrew in the world of international swimming?
It's a big deal because it's indicating a changing of the guard. The big U.S. sprinter, I mean, the most well-known, obviously, is Michael Phelps. But
I've heard of him. Yes.
Yeah, he's been around a little bit.
That's right.
But Nathan Adrian has been regarded as one of the best sprint swimmers around, and he's 29 years old now. And by swimming standards, you know, he's still very good. Mm-hmm. Make no mistake about that.
But 29 is getting up there.
Is getting up there in the world. And actually, there was an indication at the Pan Pax Championships of that when he scratched from the 50 free in order to swim the final leg of a relay team, which ended up winning gold. It was, and this is very much an individual sport, but it was very much a team decision at the same time. Mm-hmm. What that did was it politely yielded to guys like Caleb Dressel and Michael Andrew, who are the top sprinters on the USA team now.
So Michael Andrew and Caleb Dressel went 1-2 in this event, but Michael Andrews took another medal in another event. He's a multiple threat.
He is a multiple threat. At the U.S. Nationals, he also won the 100 breast. He also won the 50 fly. He is up and coming in other events. And just in the last month, Brian, In the last month, he's had 7 events in which he has established lifetime bests for himself, just in the last few weeks.
Well, joining us to talk a little bit about what it's like to have your 19-year-old son become a rising star in the world of swimming is Michael Andrew's dad and his coach, Peter Andrew. He joins us from Lawrence in the studios of Kansas Public Radio. Peter, good morning, and first of all, congratulations.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
Must have been very exciting. Were you able to watch live?
Yeah, we were actually able to watch live. We scoured around and found the Japanese an online edition in the morning, and then another feed in the evening. So it was really good to be able to watch.
Had to be a little creative with it.
Yeah, it was very creative, but we were super blessed to be able to watch him live, and it was fun.
So yesterday was his best time ever in the event, 21.46 seconds. Does he need to get faster?
Yeah, he needs to get faster. I mean, we're training to get faster and faster, and he's he has goal time set in his mind, and you know his goal time really for this meet was a 21.25. And so he was a little off that. But, I mean, you know, going personal bests the whole way is just amazing.
Sure.
Especially, you know, everything we've always done as a team. And for him to be out there and us not to be with him, and for him to be able to stand up and still perform so excellently is just amazing. You know, so we're so blessed with that.
So, well, I would want to talk about that. You have been his team. You have been coaching him right there at home. A lot of young people move away to a training center somewhere else when they pursue Olympic-level swimming. I imagine that will come. How has it worked having him there in Lawrence with you?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's what we do is so different to the traditional path of swimming. You know, we really follow a scientific approach to training. So we train at the pace you race, and it's not very popular. I believe that the change is coming, and so it's kind of, we've kind of put it in a situation where it's hard for him to move away because not many others are training this way, you know. But I know as a team, you know, we team is so important, and not just myself and him, but myself, my wife, my daughter. You know, we really, as a team, we function so effectively well. And
the team is your family.
Yeah, the team, obviously, our team is our family. And we work with other kids that come along and work with us for little bits here and there. But, you know, it's so different right now, but it's working so well.
You said it's controversial. I without getting too technical, for those of us who are not professional swimmers, what's the difference between the way you train and the way he's going to get pushed to train as part of the national team?
Yeah. Well, you know, firstly, as part of the national team, they're very considerate in that they will train him the way he is trained, because there's no way you can take an athlete that isn't trained a specific way and now try and change it, because it won't work. So what we do is we train at race pace. So if Michael is how fast he swims in a race, that's the speed we train at. And, you know, you can't do it for long distances, so we break the training up into short spans. And so he can hold that specific race technique and pace, and we train at that pace. So we're basically creating a neural pattern that he doesn't have to think when he comes to race, because he's done it over and over and over. And it's really science. I mean, we're on the cutting edge now, where there's so much science. We're learning how to train the body better. And this is the route that we've taken, and it's very effective and working very well, and he's getting better and better and better. And so, yeah, we've been blessed with USA Swimming, you know, obviously they've allowed me to show them, you know, kind of what he's doing, and then they'll, when he's on a team trip, they'll do the same, you know, as we're doing.
Will you actually come alongside those coaches? Will you be part of that training, or will you have to, in some way, as parents have to do, send him on his way?
Yeah, well, I'm his parent and his dad, and that, I guess that's a pretty foreign thing as well. It's so I'm still his coach. I was allowed on the first day to go and show the coaches, you know, this is, and it's pretty simple, like this is how we run the stopwatch, which is, you know, it's, they're kind of like thoroughbred horses, these athletes, you know, and the timing, especially for Michael, he needs to know his timing is exactly on. And so how I run the stopwatch is when his feet leave the wall, and that's kind of what I showed them. What we've done is we've really trained Michael to know what his body's saying to him. time. So, you know, when he's away from me, he can manage himself really well. And I knew, you know, going in that this is very different to the traditional path. So possibly I wouldn't be selected to go with him. Obviously, I want to be there with him. I know, you know, the better an athlete gets, the more chance his coach gets to go with him. But, you know, we've prepared him to be able to manage himself and be under other coaches. And, you know, that's really USA Swimming's decision at the end of the day, whether they keep us as a team or if they split us up. And,
sure.
You know, but he's ready for either option.
Yeah, well, I mean, every dad or mom who's coached their kid's little league team, you know, to some degree has to ask themselves what that's like and how they separate the things they want for their child as a person from the things they want for them as an athlete, as their coach. This is on a whole different level, obviously. How hard is that for you?
Yeah, you know, it's been a real learning process for us, is how, you know, how do you wear two hats, coach and father? And really it's I mean, we've had great mentors and great people come alongside us. And, you know, I've realized everything is just in love. You know, how much do I love my son? And nothing we can do can be negative. You know, it's so really, I mean, I think we're in the greatest situation right now where, you know, we totally understand each other. And I think that's the thing with team, you know, is a team. I was in a team in the military, and I know how teams function. You know, you've got to function as a unit, and we're functioning so well as a unit right now. And I mean, we've gone through dark times and good times, and we've decided, you know, whatever we've been given in the light, we won't question when we're in the dark. So when the times are a little off, you know, we stand fast and we support each other. And, you know, this is a journey we're on. We really would like to change the sport of swimming so that more of a scientific approach is adopted, and more swimmers will stay in the sport, because the amount of yardage and the training that's going on now, it's just crazy. And there is a better way, yeah. And I think Michael's beating that path, and it's going to be good for the sport, and then good for Michael, because, you know, I listened to you speaking about Nathan Adrian at 29. He's still really young. You know, I think age is just a number, and I think Michael's career, if we can keep his body healthy and well, he can go on till he's 40 years old and still be doing as well.
Peter Andrew is the father and coach of Michael Andrew, who took gold at the Pan Pacific Championships over the weekend in the 50 free. Peter, thanks so much for taking some time to be with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
We appreciate you. Greg Eklund is still with us because age is just a number, so he's going to plow ahead. And we're going to turn now to golf. Topeka native and former KU golfer Gary Woodland had his best finish in a major over the weekend with a tie for sixth at the PGA Championship in St. Louis. You know, the resurgence of Tiger Woods, the strong showing by Brooks Koepka got most of the attention this weekend. But hey, a tie for sixth comes with a $334,000 paycheck for Gary Woodland. And Greg, it sounds like that's not all.
That's not all. He also puts himself into consideration for the Ryder Cup competition, which Gary Woodland would be very much a part of. He would welcome that opportunity. He has been very vocal about his desire to be a part of a USA team, whether it be the Ryder Cup team or the President's team.
You know, that's been as frustrating as my major record. You know, I've been in the fitting, I think, for the last 7 years for all the Ryder Cup and President's Cup fittings. I've tried all the clothes on. I've seen them all. And I've never had a chance to make the team. Last year, I think, was probably as close as I made. And that's frustrating. You know, I got off to a great start this year. But I've made a lot of changes because of my major record.
So how is that Ryder Cup team shaping up then, Greg Eklund?
Eight are locked in right now. Jim Furyk is the captain. He'll name three more in early September. Then the final pick by Furyk will come about a week later.
So, I mean, let's talk about Gary Woodland for a minute for listeners who may not know him. What else has he done this year? Who's he up against?
Well, he won early in the year, got off to a great start in the season when he won down at Phoenix. Then he has changed his game a little bit. As you heard in the clip, he was very much focused on finishing better in the majors, and that paid off with his best finish yet in a major over the weekend in St. Louis.
I mean, there's some other great players who have not yet qualified, including Tiger Woods.
Well, Tiger Woods very much put himself in contention, and he has made no secret about his desire to play for the U.S. team. The U.S. Ryder Cup team is significant this year because the U.S. Ryder Cup has not been won by the U.S. on foreign soil since Tom Watson did it at the Belfry in 1993.
Gosh, that's ages ago in the world of sports. Before we leave this weekend's PGA tournament, Greg, I do want to ask, it seems like that tournament in St. Louis was a huge success for our friends across the state. I heard all kinds of great things about the course and about the fans.
Very much so. Belrive is a historic course. It's been the site of a major championship before. This was the 100th version of the PGA Championship. And it was well received in St. Louis.
Any chance we'll be seeing a PGA Tour event make its way to this side of the state?
Highly unlikely. We have some great golf courses here, but it takes more than that. It takes sponsorship and it takes facilities as far as beyond the golf course itself, like practice ranges, parking, and all those sort of things. I don't think we have that here in Kansas City.
All right, so hang in there, folks. Maybe someday. Finally, we're going to turn to tennis and another local athlete who's making a mark. This one is surely familiar to our listeners. The U.S. has a semifinal match in Davis Cup play at the end of this month. The U.S. hasn't reached the Davis Cup final since winning it in 2007, but Kansas City area resident Jack Sock has been involved with the U.S. team. And Greg, how's his game shaping up?
His singles game is not doing very well. Yeah. He's in Cincinnati this week, and this year in singles play, he's 5-14. That's almost like a Royals record so far this year.
That's better than that, but still.
In doubles play, he's much better. He's 26-9 in doubles play. He has four titles this year as a doubles partner, and he's had four different partners. This week in Cincinnati, he's playing with Mike Bryan, who was his partner when they won the title at Wimbledon. And I would think that he certainly stands a good chance to be on the U.S. Davis Cup team.
Okay, so Jack is 25 years old. He's still ranked number 14 in men's singles, at least as of last month. That's down, though, from number 8 at one point last year. Is there any concern, any reason to be concerned about the long-term trajectory of his career?
No, he's 25 years old. Roger Federer is 37 years old.
Age is just a number, as Peter Andrews said.
Exactly. So there are still a lot of good years of good tennis ahead for Jack Sock.
And what is the next test for him? Where do we look for Jack next?
Well, this is a big week. He has a big singles match this week to open in Cincinnati against another young up-and-coming tennis player, Hyun Chung from South Korea, who did very well at the Australian Open. Jack needs to get his singles game back on track.
That's contributor Greg Eklund. He reports on sports for KCUR 89.3. Greg, as always, thank you.
You're welcome, Brian.
Friday on the program, we learned about the Kansas City branch of the Black Panther Party. If you missed that conversation or any others from last week, you can find them online at kcur.org/uptodate. Also, of course, find us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUptodate. I'm at @PTSBrian. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook, too. Join us tomorrow when Steve's back, 25 years after the Great Flood of 93. We'll ask if Kansas City is any safer from catastrophic flooding. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.